Because we're just such a small group, this is supposed to be a conversation about Swamiji. So maybe it can be a conversation or questions or something you might like, rather than my just launching out on a big story here. That's a beautiful sari. Colors are so pretty. So, does anybody have anything that you would particularly like to ask or talk about or comment about? The supposed topic is the early years with Swamiji, but the topic can be whatever we want it to be. Anybody have any ideas? You all have not been very helpful this visit in terms of offering ideas. I just want to tell you that, but you can redeem yourselves now. I mean, if you came tonight, did you have something that you wanted to know about particularly? If not, I'll launch out, but... All right. Okay, I guess I'm on my own.
I just felt that the outer garb was Swamiji, but inside it was his guru. His dedication was so complete. It's almost as if there were two people who had merged into one.
You know, in 1990, Swamiji wrote the book The Essence of Self-Realization, which it might even, I may not even be looking at it right there. The Essence of Self-Realization. And he had, as you all know, Master told him to write things down. And so Swamiji had these notebooks. And I think he describes, and it was in conversations, he describes how he took care of those notebooks for his whole life. He described them, he said he lavished care upon them the way a father would lavish on his ailing only son, is how he took care of those notebooks. And after he wrote The Path, which he wrote in 1978, that whole decade passed and he didn't really write any more about Master. He just, no more books, I mean, about Master. And in 1990, he started that one, and he began to cull from those notebooks stories that he thought were relevant, and because he organized the book into chapters, he could only take certain ones. His house is a large sort of complex with his apartment underneath. Some of you have been to America, have seen it, or have seen pictures. And just some hundreds of yards away, there's a small house that is now the guest house to Crystal Hermitage, which is what his house is called. It's actually a house that my husband and I built and lived in for a few years before we left that area. So it's much smaller and cozier and slightly isolated. I don't know whether they were doing, they must have been doing construction in his house. I'm not sure why. But he moved out of his house and he moved into the guest house. And that period of time coincided with the writing of this book. And he normally wrote on a computer. The Path he wrote on an electric typewriter, and then he got a word processing computer right after that, and that's what he used for all his books, which he really liked. He often talked about how computers, for a writer, it vastly increased the creative process because between the inspiration and the capacity to express it, the physical obstacles were removed. He said, you know, when a person would have to write a sentence out in longhand, sometimes by the time you get to the end, you would lose the inspiration. But with word processing, you could just think and capture it almost at the same time. And because he was writing that book in sections where he needed to fill out different ideas, he had to not only, he said, use what was in the notebook, but he had to try to remember, cull up other things Master had said to make the book complete. And so he was in the guest house working on it, and he actually wrote the book by hand, which was really unusual because he didn't have a good hand. Something happened to his nerve somewhere along there, and writing was not so easy for him. In 1990, it may still have been not quite so bad. Because he said if he was working on the computer, he couldn't hear Master's voice. And he said he could actually hear Master speaking and saying these things to him, and he would say, you know, we need a little more about this subject, and then he would remember, and he would hear Master talking to him, and then he would write it out by hand so that he could hold that inspiration. It was quite something. And he was alone in his little house. In that time, he didn't have to always have someone with him. You know, that was that only came in the last years. Prior to that, he was always alone, unless someone was doing something with him. So he spent many, many days alone in that house with his pencil or his pen, having Master talk in his mind and then writing down what he said. And he actually said, he was telling us, he said it was so real that at one point he actually said, "Excuse me, sir, I didn't quite hear that." And it was repeated in his mind, yeah. And after he finished that, which of course for him was you can imagine, he said after that he couldn't tell what his thoughts were and what were Master's thoughts. He said it just, his mind merged so completely he couldn't tell the difference anymore. Whether or not he was articulating that or whether it was a real shift, but that was the time at which he really said out loud to all of us, "There's no difference between us now." That's quite a statement from a disciple, really. You know, there was another... There was another aspect to that which was also really important. Swamiji was always hoping that there would be a reconciliation between Ananda and SRF. Somebody asked me that question last night and I spoke to it at more length. But he just felt it was so unseemly that Master's disciples should be in disagreeing with each other. That a great deal of how he built Ananda was based on the hope that if he didn't exactly duplicate what they did but did a parallel course, that in time it could come together and it would come together harmoniously. So, as he says when he wrote the first, what's become the art and science of yoga, yoga postures was not something SRF was dealing with, so he thought that was an approach. The whole approach through Patanjali, SRF's lessons were different. He knew exactly what SRF was doing, so he was always trying to find the places where they weren't standing so he could fill in those places in the hope that eventually we'd come together. The whole idea of communities itself was something that SRF wasn't doing. And it was a constant theme. And I kind of go, ugh, like that when I say it, because in those days many of us had much less appreciation of the importance of unity than he did. And so we would become impatient at times with his determination. He wrote The Path with stories of Master, knowing that SRF would not be pleased, but he did it anyway. But then there was that long hiatus. And then he felt guided inwardly to write this book. And he also used the name, he called it the essence of self-realization, and self-realization was the word that belonged to Self-Realization Fellowship. And he did it as, I guess you would have to say, as an act of provocation. He was provoking them, and he knew it. But he felt inwardly that he was supposed to do it. As he said, he realized that we were not going to get anywhere bending over all the time so that SRF would look taller. He said he felt it was time to just approach it from a different angle, which is to just stand up strongly and bring the issues out into the open. So all of those decisions on his part, he certainly took with an enormous amount of care so as not to displease Master. So that the result of all that effort was that he felt this ever-deepening attunement. Was obviously extremely important to him, and he was so fearless. You know, he's writing this book. He's using the word self-realization, which is a word that Ananda had never used before, not in that way, not as openly. He writes to them, "You will be interested to know that I'm writing a book of the sayings of Master, and this is what I'm calling it." I mean, it was like He didn't wait to be found out.
Did he reply?
Well, yeah, their lawyers called. No, that was the beginning of 12 years of litigation. And then soon after that, he called a meeting and said that he really felt that, because now, by that time, Ananda was moving out from Ananda Village. And David and I had been sent to Palo Alto. We had a house in San Francisco. He was, Ananda and Maria were in Sacramento. He was starting, Ananda was going to behave more like a church or like a spiritual work. We were no longer going to be an isolated community. We were going to go out. We were going to reach the public. And Swamiji said, we are disciples, and Master called his work self-realization. He said, how can we call it something else? That was Master's name for his work. If we're representing him, we have to use it. So he called a meeting, and I wasn't at that meeting, but someone phoned me and said, we had a meeting today, and Swamiji has a new name for us. And just intuitively, I said, Ananda Church of Self-Realization, which is what he did. And soon after that, SRF sued us. But Swami just did it on purpose. He just said, enough already, let's just bring the issue out into the open. So it was the book, and it was changing our name that, from their point of view, required them to stand up to us, which is exactly what Swamiji was trying to do. It was like, it's all been underground, let's just bring this out in the open. I don't know if he knew it would turn into litigation, that all that would happen. But again, all of that is interesting because of what he described as such a powerful shift in attunement with Master right when he was doing that very thing, which is, I'm sure, what gave him the confidence to just go forward. Because the only reason he was concerned about the split between Ananda and SRF was because out of concern for his Master's work. He felt it wasn't right, as he said, we should all be together in this. Yesterday, someone asked me the question in a different way. Was Swami personally involved in, did he have personal feelings about the whole split between them? And there was, I made mention of the fact that for Swami's whole life, from when he was out of SRF, which was 1962, when he was 36, I said it yesterday, he never had any peers. He had lots of friends and people who loved him, and we supported him and we helped him in every way we could. And Essay asked me what the word peers meant, because English is not his first language. But when he asked me that question, I realized what I was really saying, which is Swami didn't have anyone else in his life that he could relate to on a daily basis who knew Master. And of course, for him, that was the only reality there was to have been with Yogananda. And he was always alone with that thought. There was no one he could share it with. I was thinking peers in the sense of equals, spiritual equals. But that wasn't really what created the sense of aloneness. It was that there was nobody he could talk to who had the same picture in his mind, in their mind. Until he did renew contact with a few direct disciples, Peggy Dietz, Bob Raymer. He saw Roy Eugene Davis occasionally, although not that often. He saw Norman once or twice. He saw Bernard. Bob Raymer and Peggy Dietz were the closest. Even Hare Krishna Ghosh, because Hare Krishna had seen Master. And so they could at least, they had that touch. But when he was with those people, there was a completely different quality in the way he could relate to them. And it was when I first saw him in their company that I just comprehended on a level that I'd never thought of. I had so much reverence for Swamiji and so much regard for him that I had to... work to also understand his reality as he was experiencing it. To be a true friend to him is what I would say. Because, as he said once, I have to get my energy from somewhere, is where he said. And then he sort of shrugged and said, I suppose I could get it all from inside. He said, but it's nice also to have people help me. You know, just be with him, just like all of us. If you have something that you're doing and there's somebody who's with you in it, there's more energy in that. And if that person understands what you're doing and relates to it on all levels, it's more powerful. And I was not a good friend to him for a number of years because I had a very hard time cognizing anything but his spiritual dimension. I was saying last night, this morning too, that when a great soul, even a free soul, even Master himself, incarnates on the human level, they take on the conditions of human life. So it's not like they're not affected. They're free inside, but they also have to struggle against this energy. And Swamiji often commented that he felt that many of those, especially women, because they were the ones who were loyal to Master, most of the men before Swamiji came and went, except for Rajasi, not everyone, but there were a number of the men that Master put his faith in did not fulfill his hope for them. A few of them really betrayed him, and actually Master was sued about 4 different times. I mean, these are, you know, that was, people felt that strongly to get money or to do things against him. That was very hard. I guess it's written somewhere that when at some point Master went off to Mexico and he wasn't even certain he would come back. He just sort of had it with the whole thing and just walked away, at least for a while, to decide whether he was going to deal with it. But Swamiji said that those really close disciples, he said they really didn't come for Master's mission in the way that Swamiji did. They came for Master. And I don't just mean that spiritually, because of course all the disciples did, but they came to help him, you know, to just literally cook his food and take care of his house and be always supportive, so that there was always this supportive energy flowing in. It was just a completely different purpose. And even though Swamiji was close to him, Swamiji came at the end of Master's life, and he often told us that Master talked to him in ways Swamiji believes he didn't talk to anyone else. He talked about what he wanted for his mission, and he didn't really talk to some of the women who were with him for much longer, because they weren't interested in it, they didn't have the temperament for it, and that isn't why they incarnated. It's so fascinating when you really sort of see a whole picture. And then, of course, there's us, who are here in a wholly different way, at a wholly different time. You know, the whole energy of the guru's consciousness just kind of goes through all these waves and waves until the wave crests, I suppose, over many generations, who can say? Anyway, interesting. Any other thoughts or questions? You know, I had never thought of the relationship between that special attunement that book created and what he was doing at that time. When I go home, I'm going to write about all these things. So that was... it's interesting. I hope I have many such understandings, putting all the pieces together.
I heard from Master, you know, there's so many organizations where people of less spiritual nature have made themselves into so-called gurus. He never did that. He said Master is the guru.
Right.
And somewhere the two had just merged into one and continued all his life. And his greatness lied in his humility and the fact that he was so loyal to Master.
I think so.
It's
agree.
It's like two energies getting merged into one.
I always, from the first I met him, I felt he was certainly the closest thing to Master that I would ever meet. And even from the beginning, if there was any difference between them, which I didn't discern any, I couldn't discern any, I wasn't capable of, I figured it was close enough to work for me. And I always just treated him as if Master were speaking to me. Insofar as I was able. And it worked. I was reading actually in Hindu Way of Awakening just an hour or two ago. Swamiji was talking about satsang and finding a guru in that book, completely unrelated to this. But he said, many, God can use instruments even if those instruments aren't perfect. But if the devotee is sincere, God will work perfectly through those instruments. And it just was a really sweet way to put it, to realize we don't have to worry so much about these things. In the early years, odd as it may seem, people were always, not always, many people were a little suspicious. Is that Swami speaking or is that Master speaking? Is that his personality or is that him? To me, it was like the chances of Swami being right were so much greater than the chances of me being right that I couldn't. I would often say, whatever difference there is between him and Master, I can't see it. Whatever difference there is between Swamiji and me is very, very clear. So if I can cross that distance, I'll worry about the last piece of it. But of course, it was never an issue. The early years were very different than the later years. He had to take a lot of doubt because he never asserted himself and presented himself so humbly. People who weren't sensitive didn't know what they had in him. And so there was a lot of energy that would swirl around of criticism and questioning and it was tiresome for him. And from time to time he would leave the country just for a while, just to get away from it. But he followed the advice he gave us later when we had to start our own communities. Just find the people who are in tune and want to work positively and give all your energy to them. He said, and just don't pay any attention to the others. Don't make a great effort to convert people who doubt. He said, if you create the magnetism at the center, he said, those people will either get drawn into that positive magnetism or the force of this will spin them out. So we had many, many people, especially in those first 15 or 20 years, just many people came and went. I mean, hordes sometimes. On a couple of occasions, he drove away, a few dozen people just because enough was enough. When the fire came and it burned down the community. In the movie, Jyotish and Devi don't quite explain that, but everybody who defined Ananda as a really nice place for me to live in my house, in this pretty wooded area, and have my children and my life, God burned down very selectively at that point. There was a whole area, which was what we called then the farm, which is really the community, and there were individual houses there, and a lot of the people living in those houses were not in tune with where Ananda was going. And so this fire came, and it burned down every one of those houses. It did not burn the publications building. It did not burn the public area. It went right up to the edge where all the monks and nuns lived, which was where Swami also lived, which was a group that was really with him. It went literally right to the edge of that, did not cross that road. The fire had to sometimes kind of go like this to pick up a house, but it did. And then there was one house left standing, and a month later an oak tree fell on it and crushed most of it. And then a large group of people left, like maybe 40 people, maybe something like that. Might have even been, do I have that accurate? Well, I think it was a very large group, because they didn't have their own scene anymore. And even the beautiful land was gone. It was black ash and scarred trees. I'd lived there for years and I got lost. I got lost walking from where I lived, which was in the monastic area, over the hill to the publications building, because all the landmarks were gone. And I just sort of suddenly found myself, I didn't even know where I was, because I couldn't recognize anything. But we encouraged people to go at that point, and they didn't have anything to relate to. That's what I was trying to say. They didn't have anything to relate to, because the ideal of Ananda just wasn't real to them. And what Devi described in the movie, well, she just backed up from all that physical and realized that everything that was real, she still had, and everything that was material was gone. So it shifted the community. When I was telling someone somewhere, the day that fire came, it was so, like nothing really bad had ever happened to us. And you never believe it's really going to happen to you. And we were standing up on the ridge, looking down the other side, and the fire was there, and we're just watching it like this. And I was with Jyotish. Jyotish, this fire looks like, there's nothing but dry brush. This fire is huge. The wind is behind it. It's burning uphill, and fires burn faster uphill because the fire, the heat rises and it dries out everything in front of it. So it just, you know, it just, it's a raging inferno. The thing just starts coming. I said, "Judges, this looks like it's going to burn our community. You're so incredulous." Wow, looks like it really is. And it came up the hill like this, and our houses were in very densely wooded areas. And it went right to that housing area while we watched. And then it went straight up the tree. Then it does something they call tree topping, where it goes from the top, the tops of the trees. So we just sort of watched that, and then all of a sudden it's all in the housing area. And everything shifted from, "We can't stop this fire, there's no way we can stop this," to trying to grab what we could to get ahead of it. And so people went off in cars and trucks, running to those houses, trying to pull out what they could before they burned. Because some of the good people who were really key, Durgan, Vidura, Jyotish and Devi, among them Lakshmi, all their houses went down too. Sadhana Devi and Jaya, their house went down. And it was so fast that very little was pulled out, just very little. The story they always tell about Jyotish is that somebody, he was going to his own house, Devi was off the land, and somebody called out to him, "Take everything that's valuable to you," which is a terrible thing to have said to Jyotish, at least the way the story was told, because he stood there and he thought, "What is of value to me?" So he took, like, there were things on the altar. Jyotish, this may be apocryphal, but this is how the story is told, that they were cleaning their altar and all their little altar things were on one place. I'm told that Jyotish picked that box up and walked out of the house. And someone else came and got some of the baby's clothes and, you know, stuff that you might want. People were clearing out somebody else's house because it all happened so quickly. Since then, people started leaving signs, "In case of fire, please take these things." But it was, there was a spirit right in the moment of just, people's houses were literally burning, and we were down in the farm area, and we were laughing, and we were talking about the little bit that we'd rescued, and we were just watching the smoke close in and just wonder what was going to be left. And they sent me up. I must have been in charge of publications then, but up to the publications building on the hill, and Seva and I were just running up that hill as fast as we could and just talking about what we were going to take out of the building. They took some trucks up there and we just threw as much as we could in. We took the original print negatives for the books and original recordings, but the first thing we took was the mailing list. I'm running up the hill saying to Seva, "We're going to have to rebuild and we're going to need money. We better get the mailing list," because there were no computers, it was physical. So we gathered up, there were these metal plates. That was the first thing. We just gathered them all and took them into the truck because that's what we were going to need. Just tried to get it. And we had a press, huge press. They told me later it weighed 5,000 pounds. I got a couple of people to push on it with me to see if we could get it out of the building. I mean, you know, of course we couldn't move it. It was so heavy. And then someone started to pick up a copy machine, and I shouted out, "Leave that there, it's leased. Belongs to someone else, let it burn." But the publications didn't burn. The fire, they were able to light a backfire, and the fire came right up to the edge. But there was no reason for it to burn, because that part of our work was in tune. What needed to be pulled out was those houses of the people who didn't understand. And then we needed as Swami said later, the people who were really committed got to have the opportunity to experience their own commitment. You know, you've lost everything. What is Ananda? So it was an enormous turning point for the whole community. What is Ananda? Is it a place? Or is it an attitude, an opportunity to serve? And from that point on, we were much more in keeping. But this is what I was saying about Swami. For those first 10 years or so, there was just a lot of conflict. What is Ananda? He was building this community for Master, and then there was another coterie of people who were trying to build it for themselves. And they had just very different points of view. And finally, the Mind Mother got tired and just sent that fire to sort it out. Yeah. It was fun. I'm not sure the people who lost their houses would say that, but it was fun. It was tiring, but it was fun. There was a picture of me that Swami always held as the example the next day. A couple of days later, we were cleaning up the brush out there in the forest, you know, just covered with ash, and somebody snapped my picture, and of course, you know, I go like that. So we always Swami always pointed to that picture, you know, that was the attitude, that's the spirit. Just burn down, let's clean it up. So it's always dramatic moments are very helpful. Puts you where you need to be.
The purification happened, which is what the fire does.
It was very purifying, extremely purifying. Purified us externally, purified us internally. Why am I here? What is my life? What does it mean to be part of a spiritual group? No. And we don't always have to lose everything to realize that, but when you do or come close, it's gratifying. And you could see Devi when she talked about it in the movie, it was gratifying. It was a challenge. I mean, you know, they've had one child, and that baby was 10 days old. I mean, just think of it. I mean, she was a new mother. They were new parents. She was a new mother. She had a 10-day-old infant in her hand. That's very, very small. Suddenly, she doesn't even have a place to go. What to speak of having anything that she had. She's just holding this tiny baby. It wasn't even just her life. It was a great moment for them. It was a really great moment for them to stand into that. And that's the other reason it happened, Swamiji said, so that we could have that fact. This is how you respond. So people can't say, oh, you had it so lucky. Ananda burned twice that way. The temple burned once. We lost a temple that Swamiji had worked so hard to build, and he finally moved out of the city and moved to Ananda Village, I think on June 1st of 1970, and on July 4th it burned to the ground, the temple, which was the heart and soul of everything. Just somebody left a candle burning, and it caught fire, and that was that. I came for the first time in August, so when I came it was just, they'd stripped it back to the base, so, yeah, quite something. But there you have it. That, Swami tells that story about, you know, he just thought, oh dear, it's gone. And he said he felt so much joy in meditation when he just offered it back to Divine Mother. That's what he wrote. He said, do you want to take any of the other buildings to Divine Mother? It was like, if I can have this much joy about losing the temple, what would happen if we lost all of them? He wasn't suggesting it, but he was ready for it. So when I see the Pune community just being so rough, and so much needing to happen, it's like, okay, great. You know, people just drag it up out of the mud, you know, inch by inch, and
there we have fire every year.
Yeah, fire every year. Oh, that's right. It came close this year, didn't it? Yeah.
Fire also there.
You know, God can have his way with us in a heartbeat. When I saw that fire come through, which we were right there in the heart of it, it was like we're just ants in Divine Mother's hand, and at any moment she can just go like that. This illusion that we are in charge of our lives is so foolish. I was in an earthquake in Palo Alto in 1989. It was I suppose it made the news here too. It was where a piece of one of the big bridges fell. So that little snip of that bridge falling was shown a million times on the news. Earthquakes don't have to last long. And our particular area our community is apparently on a fairly solid piece because a lot of it kind of went around us. But I was inside the building when it started to shake. And I was watching this building just go like this. And one of the way my mind works, one of the things that crossed my mind was that there was no such thing as earthquake proof, no matter what anybody told you. That if God wants to knock your building down, it is of no consequence to him. He can knock it down no matter what you've done. And then I I really wanted to get out of that building because it was going like this. I'm just watching it just go like this. So somewhere in your mind, you think, the problem is with the building. So I rushed outside because the apartment was really small and the outdoors was just a few steps away. I rushed outside and the trees, of course, were going like this. And you could see the ground undulating like this. And the swimming pool, which was right nearby, the water came up out of the swimming pool. Not all of it, but a lot of it came up out, went up over about a 10-foot space and came over a wall like that. And everything about you is looking for the place where it isn't happening. Because, we're just accustomed to the earth just staying in its place. And when the earth itself moves, everything is gone. And I did not respond well. I did not think, oh, Master, whatever you want. I was thinking, it took me longer than I'm proud to admit before it occurred to me to surrender. In between, I was just completely bewildered. But it had a very salutary effect on my spiritual life, which is we are always just a second away from being annihilated if God wants to. Remember Swami said about Master saying that God eats people? Remember that? And he said, Master said, God eats people. And then he went... just such a picture, And that's the truth. You can just take the whole thing, just in a second. When some people were trying to convince Swamiji once, there was a big movement about nuclear war. Something got started in California, which was really to try to get a grassroots initiative to ban nuclear weapons worldwide. And part of their method, they were very systematic and very sincere. And they saw Ananda, and they thought if they could get the whole of Ananda behind this, it would be very powerful. So they made an appointment with Swamiji and brought their presentation, which was very well thought out. And it involved this big chart, and they had some arbitrary city, Los Angeles, New York, Washington, something like that. And they had concentric circles of if a nuclear bomb of this particular power hits at this particular point on the city, and then there were all these little numbers. 500,000 people will be instantly vaporized. And then another 200,000 will be turned to ash. And then this many people will be severely burned and die within an hour. It was really graphic and gruesome by a certain point of view. And Swami listened to it. And then after it was over, he said two things. First, he said, if your object is peace, fear is not the right tactic. And then the second thing he said was, 100 years from now, almost no one on this planet will still be here. He said, so whether we dribble out over the next century or all leave together, he said, when we're in the astral world, it won't make any difference at all. It's just like we're in God's hands. It doesn't really make any difference. And then he commended them for their sincerity, but encourage them to work at it from a different angle. So, who knows? I don't know what I'd do in another earthquake. I'd like to think that I would surrender more quickly, but we'll see if it happens. Huh. Any other thoughts or ideas? Or? While I'm talking about the fire, I'll just go on with it then. Swamiji was not in the community when the fire happened because it was June of 76 and somebody had given him an apartment in Hawaii and he was editing the first part of The Path, his autobiography was the first major book he wrote. He wrote several shorter ones before that. But then that was, when he was working on that book, he said, the way he kept saying it was, this is my effort to really make Master popular and to really make Ananda known. And he said, if it doesn't work, we'll just live quietly here and I'll have done my best. And if it works, then our work will expand and more will happen. And if it doesn't, I'll have done what I could and we'll happily live very quietly up here in the hills. We had such a, from my point of view, such an idyllic life. We lived very isolated, like the Pune community is now. We lived extremely simply. People did come and see us. I mean, we had a retreat, but we didn't advertise it really well, and we didn't have that many people. We really let the world come to us. And Swamiji was just right in the middle of everything. Everything was so small, and he was so busy making the community happen that he was always in it. We had weekly satsangs with him, and he was very accessible all the time, except when he was writing. Well, I say that all the time, but when he was writing, he actually protected himself a lot from visitors. We'd come over every, I think, Thursday night, and he would read to us out of his book. He would read the latest chapters. And he was training us all the way through. He would read those chapters, and then he would ask us for input. And almost no one would say anything. People would just sit there. And finally, after several weeks of this, or even months of it, Swami just became very impatient. He said, you're treating me like a jukebox. He said, just put your money in and I just keep talking. He said, I'm reading you this book because I want your feedback. In other words, he wanted people to wake up and respond and not just always be passively absorbing his energy. He became very impatient with us one night. He said, you know, this is very important writing, and I want you to tell me, am I communicating? Is it saying what you want to say? Do you understand it? And he was right, really. People were just being very passive and afraid and just not engaging with the energy that he wanted. And, he, you know, he sort of threatened to cut us off somehow if we didn't really come into that. So people tried harder. But he was right. It was just low energy. It wasn't really that people were beyond commenting. They were below commenting. This morning when we were in Noida, Vijay, Swami Vijay, who's there, he and I are of the same generation of Ananda. He came perhaps months after I did, but we were there at the same time. He, Keshava, came at that same time. I think I was on the land before both of them, but only by a very short period of time. And he just made a comment, you know, about the challenge of being with Swamiji. You think about it as just a blessing, but he was also commenting about the challenge of it. I never thought of it as difficult, but it was real, because Swami demanded that you be present. And a lot of us are in the habit of not always being present, just tuning out, just falling into whatever it is we fall into. Seva said that Swamiji, because she had that habit, Seva was met Swamiji shortly after Jyotish did and was in San Francisco and helped him a lot in San Francisco and then moved later. And she said she had the habit of not paying attention. And sometimes she said he would just say absurd things to her just to see if she was listening. and to force her to pay attention, because she just wasn't accustomed to that. She wasn't accustomed to thinking in words. And he really was trying to wake her up. I never saw that, but she said that he did it. He would just say preposterous things just to see if, you know, well, the building is on fire and I suppose we should go outside. What do you think? You know? But you always had to be, you had to be really alert. You could not go to sleep. You had to be listening and you had to be thinking. Because he wouldn't have you around if you were just dull. And so that to me, but to me that was the tremendous fun of it, was that he was always keeping you on your toes and you really couldn't go to sleep. I didn't like going to sleep, so I really enjoyed that. Just always having to sort of hear what was happening and respond and pay attention and you know, and sometimes just making a colossal idiot of yourself, but those are the things that happen. But see, for me, what it did for me was, well, I discovered how much fun it was to be wide awake. And so it was an incentive to be wide awake all the time. And I remember specifically, he put me in the kitchen right away. I arrived on June 1st, and by July I was working in the kitchen running, that was the cooked for the whole retreat, the whole community basically. We had two locations. All the out-of-tune people mostly were at the farm, and Jyotish, God bless him, was managing that whole scene. And Swami lived at the seclusion retreat, and that's where we were. Then he moved to Ayodhya. But so my cooking was not only for the guests, but really from about 30 residents. And I couldn't cook at all, which was a problem, but I was capable of getting food out there. It just wasn't very good. So I went in the middle of July, and on the 1st of August or so, the woman who was really in charge, who knew how to run it, had a family emergency in the middle of the night. She packed up and went away and never came back. So the whole thing was in my hands at that point. And Swamiji would come. He started giving Sunday service every other Sunday. And we would serve lunch to the whole community afterwards. And on the Sundays that Swamiji was there, I would get up really early and I would do my very best to cook the nicest meal I could, and just because he was there. And on the Sunday that he wasn't there, I just put any old thing that was in the refrigerator on the table. But after a while, that didn't feel good to me, because it wasn't merely that I was taking care of him, it was that I was taking care. I was putting out dynamic energy. I was really thinking about serving. And so sort of in that way, when the incentive was there for you to rise to the occasion, you realize the joy of rising to the occasion. So at some point I realized that wasn't working, and I started trying to be equal at all times to what I was doing. But in those ways, in many different ways, his company was really helpful. But when the fire came and he was in Hawaii working on the book, he said he woke up that morning with a really uneasy feeling. He really felt something, there was a black cloud somewhere. And in the middle of the afternoon when he got the call that this fire had come, and he booked a plane, and by the next morning he was there with us. And he immediately just called this big meeting, and it was, well, it's all burned down and we're going to need a lot of money. What are we going to do? I mean, there was just not a second. And then we started organizing. We'll have a fundraising event here. We'll have a concert. This person can do that. Where is everybody going to live? How are we going to manage it? It just, he didn't miss a beat. He just went forward. And we all just sort of went with him. And then he said that he felt the best thing he could do to help the situation was to finish the book. So within a couple of days, he just left for Hawaii and left us there to sort it out. I mean, what could he do? He wasn't going to pick up a shovel or a wheelbarrow, so he did. But then what he did after that was he set up a nationwide tour. He said, well, we're going to need more energy here because we've had a huge setback. He always responded to challenge by expanding. I mean, not one of us would ever have thought that the proper response to the community burning down was to take 12 people and travel around the United States giving programs. Just like, it was not a logical connection in our minds. But whenever there was a difficulty, Swamiji always met it by expanding his energy. Most people try to contract and save what they have. And in all these ways, he was so dynamic. You have a problem, you try to save what you have. Somebody's been unkind to you, try to save what what little equanimity you have. You don't think about getting bigger and just embracing that person. You try to hide from them. And so we lost everything, so let's get bigger. So he gathered up a dozen people and got a van, and then someone bought him a motorhome, and they just set off across the country. And they went to 30 cities and did the practice of joy. Swami gave, and they would come into a town and all these dozen people would set up the hall and decorate the hall. And they had these all-day seminars and they'd cook lunch in the motorhome and serve lunch to, and you know, sometimes 50 people would come, sometimes 5 would come. Sometimes our choir would outnumber all those people. And Swami made these little, they call it little dresses that were, well, awful, really awful. Little rainbow trim, and the men had to wear these little outfits. They looked like something like a waitress would wear in a restaurant. And but he wanted, you know, that everybody to look, the little rainbow ribbon on it. And he just had all of us out there just putting out big energy. And we didn't make any money on those tours. We lost fairly substantial. But a whole lot of people who became extremely important to the community all found Ananda through Swami going around. It was like he went out to find his children. My husband was one of them. So I've always been very grateful for the whole thing. But he pulled all these people in. It's like he always, he was so outside of what everyone else was doing. We were just plodding along here and he was just shooting over the top. And, you know, anyway, it was great fun. I think Shivani traveled with him on that. I'm trying to remember. Durga and Vidura. I organized the first one. She organized the second. Yeah. So.
Did you go to Italy also?
Did I go to Italy? No. He sent us, my husband and I, to Palo Alto in 1986. And we've never gotten out of there. I thought that I'd be part of a lot more communities. But no, he just sent us there. We never got out of it. But we would visit. So my perspective was like helicopter. I'd drop in, you know, travel to where he was and see him there. No, those are big stories, though. Those are Shivani's stories. He sent Shivani to Italy and us to Palo Alto at the same time. A good question. In 1979, Swamiji started an initiative he called Super Conscious Living, which is, these are the of the many things. Swamiji has done so much fine work that just got buried by other fine work. And he had this inspiration for a system he called Super Conscious Living, which is still there and is still fabulous. And it's like a whole approach to the spiritual path that you can teach as a unit, and it really has everything in it. So he wanted to launch that himself in San Francisco. This is like after two nationwide tours, then he decides that he really wants to establish our work in San Francisco. So we decided to rent a very prestigious hall called the Palace of Fine Arts, which is a beautiful place, really an elegant place. It had 1,000 seats, which was like just way more people than we'd ever had at any event. Swamiji was not a big name. And for 6 weeks ahead of time, he had all these different groups. We called it the Blitz Tour. And we went through we would go through six different cities. Six different groups went through six different cities sequentially, teaching communities, relationships, healing. It's actually, I looked at it recently, the materials, it's still perfect. We should just pull it out and do it again. And so we had these little teams in vans, and the van would go out and it would do these programs, and then it would come back and it would pick up a different team and that would do it. And it was all to build energy for this big event that he did there. And And then he spent the summer in San Francisco. We had almost 1,000 people at that event. It was a huge, huge success. And on the heels of that, we had a little house, and then he found this mansion, this 5-story, 45-room mansion in the most expensive area of San Francisco. We always live in the best areas. And then he set up this big ashram house there, and he put Jyotishin Devi in charge of it. With their son was really small, and they had to start an urban house there. And then we started a house also where I live in Palo Alto, because we bought East West Bookshop. And it went on like that for a while, and we also had a small house in Sacramento. But the attitude of mind, this is the point, was still that Ananda Village was Ananda. And these were sort of bleak outposts where you might get sent, and you would get stranded out there for maybe a year and a half, and you would do good work for a year, and then you would be really sad for 6 months, and then you would get to come home. That was our urban community, sort of. I'm exaggerating, but not by much. It was just, and even the people running it only thought of it kind of as a gateway to find good devotees and to send them back to the real Ananda, which was Ananda Village. And we just didn't have the mindset for what we were doing. We served, and Jyotishin Devi were very dedicated to that house, and actually Brian's father came in to Ananda through that house, so some good things happened. And it was a fabulous place, and much good happened, but there was still this orientation. And then in 1986, he sent Ananta and Maria to Sacramento, and he sent us to Palo Alto. And it seemed to David and to me, we the times had changed, and it seemed to us that we had to take this seriously. We couldn't just consider this to be exile. And it seemed to us that if Master's work was ever going to grow, there had to be a pattern that was bigger, that was different than this one community. So we very conscientiously took everything away from Ananda Village, and we gave our house to Swamiji to be a guest house. We didn't want to have anything holding us there. And then David went to Swami and said, what do you want me to do? Ask that question. What do you see for this community? We had an ashram house. We had a big house like this where actually about 20 people lived together. But it wasn't a viable model. You know, it wasn't really like going to spread the idea like wildfire, because it was too difficult. How many people can live together in a big house? No couples could really live there. No one with children could really live there. So David said, Swamiji, the natural thing, what do you want me to do? What is your vision? What do you see? Swami looked right at David and said, I don't know. He said, you'll be there. You're going to be the one who knows. He said, after you're there for a while, why don't you come back and tell me? And that was the instruction. But it was actually very exactly right. Because it wasn't as if Swamiji didn't move with us, because we felt him like on our, just right here the whole time, and everything seemed to move with his energy, but it just unfolded in its own way. And so we ourselves just saw what was needed and tried to make it happen. But when we were about to move into the community that we now have, because the property values in that area are so high, that property was selling for $5 million then. Now it's like worth about $15 million. And Ananda itself couldn't buy it and still doesn't own it, which is I wish it did. So it was bought by a group of sympathetic investors for the purpose of our renting it from them. And it's actually has been a very profitable purchase on their part and beneficial in ours. And the Ananda system is, if somebody has a good idea and they want to do it, you say, well, that's good. You know, we encourage each other, because most ideas never find fruition. And it's easier just to encourage and see what can happen. So we told everyone that we were getting this community and, you know, what the plan was. And we told Swami and we told lots of people. Everybody said, fine, fine. But then when it actually looked like it was going to happen, there was a kind of panic among a number of people at Ananda Village, because this property was more expensive than the entire assessed value of Ananda Village. It was just, everything about it seemed so out of proportion. And there were no other urban communities at that time. They were just single houses being rented with groups living in it. It was a whole departure from anything we'd done. I was in seclusion, and we got a message. We got summoned to Ananda Village. David immediately said, you know, they're going to nix this plan. He has a good intuition. I said, no, no. Everybody said, yes, it's just fine. Well, we got called into a room, and Swamiji was there and all of the people who are the leaders of Ananda. And Swami just started the meeting by saying that this just, we can't back this plan. We don't have the energy to expand like this. There's no way we can support this plan. And David and I were sitting there. This turned into a famous Ananda meeting. I immediately had I knew I was having an emotional reaction. And I knew that if I became emotional, this was not going to be a good meeting. So I had the sense to say almost not a word through the whole meeting. Anything I wanted to say, I whispered to David, and he said it. He had no emotional reaction. He just remained absolutely calm. And David said, well, I can understand why you wouldn't want to back it. It never occurred to us to draw any energy from here to do it, you know? We weren't thinking of money, we weren't thinking of people. And we ended up talking for 3 hours in which every possible objection to it was raised, and David calmly and with complete neutrality just answered every single objection that was raised and clarified the fact that, you know, of course you don't have any energy here. We just never even thought about that. And I think the only thing I said was, well, if we don't do this, we have to do something of equal magnitude, because the people in our area are people who really have big energy and make big things happen, and they have to do something. We can't just, they need to get engaged. We need a big challenge. And at the end of 3 hours, Swami reversed himself and thought it was a great idea. And ever after, he complimented David. And he said how much he appreciated the fact that he did not use emotion to persuade. That he just kept the whole discussion just on the level of whether this was a good idea or not, and didn't try to, we're so committed, we'll be so embarrassed, you know, or anything like that. And as I said, I knew I wasn't going to be able to hold that standard, so I just let him do it. And it was, obviously it all worked out really well. It was a very, very interesting cycle. And so once that model got set, which we set at first, of just taking an existing apartment complex and converting it to a community, that's what began to happen. And Swamiji we just said to Swami, you know, we're going to replicate everything that we can replicate. Why not? We'll take it as far as we can take it. Why not? And that just became the watchword. The only thing he stopped us from doing is we actually thought someone was going to give us a retreat property. Turned out that they were going to sell it to us, but we thought they were going to give it to us. And the Expanding Light was struggling at that time, and that Swami told us not to do that. When it was even for sale and we were going to look into it, he said, if you put a retreat that close to San Francisco, he said, it'll just kill the Expanding Light. You can't do it. But a few years later, he said, the Expanding Light is strong enough. Go ahead if you can. We were never successful. And then he told us we were going to close down the ashram house before we had the community. And he called us the night before and said, don't do that. He said, it's not fair to the people living there. And I think that's all the specific instruction he ever gave us. Just those two things. Two don't do that's. Yeah. But when we stood up and when we were dedicating the community in 1989, he was there. And I was standing up and speaking. He was sitting behind me. And I can't say I had been as conscious of it on a day-to-day basis, but standing there having brought things to that point where we actually were really looking at an urban community, and Swami stood up and said, so sweet, Babaji is very pleased with this. That's what he said. If you can show that in an area, milieu, as worldly as this, that people can still live a deep spiritual life, he said, you have really proved something. And Babaji is very pleased with this. And somehow in that context, I became profoundly aware of the fact that he had been doing all of it. That even though we had been working really hard, that the veil just lifted and I realized that not one idea had been mine. That every one of them had just come right through, you know, right through from him. We were moving. Well, we always knew it was his. It was actually fascinating to me because there we were in charge of our own community, which, you know, I'd never done that before. But we knew how to do everything because I just stop and think, what did Swami do? And there wasn't one situation that we met where I couldn't draw upon his example. Just every time. It was just all right there. So we just did what he did. Not as well, of course, but in our own way we did it. And then standing there, it was like, oh yeah, congratulations, Swami, well done. And then he would say, you know, I'm the founder of 8 or 9 communities. And it was funny because he's told us 2 things in 27 years, 28 years, but he's the founder of the community. Just completely. That's just the truest statement I know. I never think of myself in any role except just being there to help. Because he founded it. We just, you know, this planet is so different than we think. Yeah. Any other thoughts or questions? But his idea for urban communities is everything you can possibly think of to manifest. It's like, why not? We had the thought, and we actually had discussions. I mean, all of this seems so self-evident now, but we actually had discussions about whether it was possible to make a community outside of Ananda Village. And we argued that there had to be devotees who had the destiny to build these other communities. We had to. That must be that there was another model. Now it's obvious, but it's just amazing how small your mind can be. And we had to train people because people would just say Ananda and meant Ananda Village. And I was always, somebody would say Ananda and I would say village, like that. So that they could get the thought that it was something other than geography. I think what's going to happen to us now, especially after finding happiness really does its little job, which I don't know how many years that'll be, is that the concept of Ananda is not going to have any geography to it. Ananda is going to be a vibration, a way of life, an attitude toward things. People will speak of Ananda and they'll mean what this means, and then there will also be places. I think that finding happiness, and as it happens, the death of Swami, are just going to, there'll be no geographic reality. That'll be incidental to Ananda. That this, it'll be the spirit that'll really define it. It'll be a movement. But we'll see. That's why that movie is so interesting. That movie was so fun. We knew what we were doing, but really we had no idea what we were doing. Ted Nicolau fortunately knew what he was doing. But the way the movie came out, which is a fascinating catalog of all the ideas that are Ananda, But through the faces of the people who did it. And then Devi, so beautifully at the end, and she hadn't seen the movie, but just stood up and said, you know, it's not important as a place, but it's important for the ideals that it represents. And so it's just a perfect vehicle to get people to understand all the different ideas, because that's what's exciting to them, all these different ways, different facets that you can think about. So who knows what'll happen.
Swami said in Pune also that to focus on the city center
Right.
Yeah, he mentioned actually many times because everybody was focusing on the community there, but nobody was doing much in the city. I said that focus on the city. Even he said that take a bigger property on the rent. And
yeah. Well, you can't have a community unless you have people. And you generally have to go where the people are and get them interested. And from the point of view of building like that, because I know it, because I've done it, I've actually done it several times, even though we were only responsible for Palo Alto. In the 5 years before, I was traveling to Portland and Seattle a lot and helped sort of pull both of those places to the point where more could happen. And it's you just have to talk, you have to go where the people are. And you have to, if it's interesting because when I would visit in Pune, you know, Swami and I had several conversations about, this was before he was on the land, when he was still in those apartments, about, you know, we have to get something going in the city here. We can't just take all this out to the country and expect people to come and find us. We have to go where they are. It's the most important tool for starting a community is a microphone. You just have to have a microphone. Just walk around with a microphone. I don't mean a loudspeaker, but a microphone. Because you've got to get people interested and magnetized to it. Definitely, you've got to get a conduit going. Now it's happening. People are traveling and teaching all over India. But yeah, that's the way to make it work. Yeah.
That took energy away from Gurgaon also, because a lot of people moved from Gurgaon to Pune in the beginning.
Yeah.
So, because everything was focused here. Mm-hmm. Somebody came yesterday and she was asking about, so where is this person, where is that person? Uh-huh. We now have 5-6 yeah. different city centers, and everybody, there are 2 people at different centers,
yeah.
like Bangalore, Chennai,
yeah.
Pune, and you know, different centers. So now there are 20 people in Gurgaon, and now there are
yeah.
5 different centers, and there are 2 people each.
Yeah, it's. But it's timing. It's 10 years now, and it's the right time to do it. And everything is stretched really thin, but everything is always stretched really thin. I heard of some ashram, and whether this was true or not, where every time they started gaining any ground financially, the guru of that ashram made sure he pushed them close to bankruptcy again. I don't know if this was true, or I don't even remember who it was, but it was told to me as a true story. Because he thought it was better for the devotees. So, you know, it's like in the early years of Ananda, it was, from some people's perception, it was so chaotic. Nothing was ever orderly. Nothing was ever done well. Everything was just half done. And Swamiji was always switching directions. He was always moving us around. I believe it was 7 jobs in 14 months. I don't think it was 14 jobs in 7 months. I think it was 7 jobs in 14 months. I said, I either washed out really quickly or learned really fast, and I really wasn't going to put my mind to which one it was. But he was always just shifting us around, always. It was only in the late 80s that people started sticking. And he said at that time, he said, and it seemed preposterous to us then, oh, many of you are going to have communities of your own, and you're going to need to know everything. You can't just know one section. You have to know all parts of it. And many of us afterwards did. He would say that. It was like, yeah, sure. Just was so outside the possibility. But in fact, all that moving around, I did learn a lot. And just what I said, I knew what Swami would do in all those circumstances. I knew what I thought he would do. But it was like the whole thing was whirling chaos in the middle, like it was a ball that was going like this, but the whole ball kept moving. It never made any sense. Nope, it wasn't nice linear. It was just this big swirling mess, and then the whole thing would move. An Austrian attorney came to stay with us for a summer. You can imagine how exact his mind was. He just was... he was in a constant state of upset because nothing was operating the way he thought it should operate. But after the full summer, he had to concede that even though it was completely incomprehensible to him how anything could actually function there, somehow it did. And he was right. It just, there was a magnetic force. And I think that's exactly what you have going here. I mean, now it's also coming into some order. But these are a lot. I mean, some of it is just, well, I'll tell you this. When we were in San Francisco trying to build that center, I volunteered. I didn't belong there. I wasn't really part of that group. But I volunteered because I was restless. So Swami humored me and let me be there. But he never gave me any responsibilities. And in fact, he was driving back and forth to Ananda all the time, and he always had me drive with him because I really wasn't part of that group and I shouldn't have been there. I've never volunteered again. But I was watching some of it. And, you know, he was giving a lot of programs, and sometimes we just did not get it publicized properly. We didn't get it announced right. We didn't do what he asked us to do for the same swirling mess. And so after Swamiji went to a city an hour away from San Francisco to give a class series that had not been properly advertised, and no one or almost no one came, and somebody said, "Well, I guess Divine Mother just did what she wanted to do here." And Swami said, "Please leave a little space for human error." Like that. So we have to leave a little space for human error. But nonetheless, I think there's a divine wire that people are pulling on. And it's being pulled out from a divine center. And definitely sometimes it knots, and sometimes it electrocutes some of the people who are holding on to it. But overall, there's what I call a magnetic truth. When we moved to Palo Alto and started this other community, there really wasn't, as I said, there really wasn't another one. There were ashram houses, but there was nothing that was really a community. And Ananta was working simultaneously. Ananta and Maria also had the same feeling that David and I did, which is, you know, this is the rest of our life, rather than this is an interlude and then we go back to our life. So we were. Maybe you can advise us. And in the dream, he was horrified, 50 years. And then he turned to me and he said, "Well, Asha also should speak." And he turned to me and I was this withered old woman. And I was still living in Palo Alto, you know, running the community. This was his nightmare sort of picture. But now let's see, where was I going with that? We were saying, yes. We just sort of started to see what would happen. And it was fascinating to me to see that the same spiritual dynamics were just unfolding. The same way that people would sort of learn about the teachings, the same way that they would gradually wake up to what was happening, the way they would gradually begin to appreciate Swami, the way they would begin to appreciate the spiritual family, even the way the interpersonal dynamics worked, which is unique. Ananda's interpersonal dynamic is not like anything else. And it began to replicate itself. And I was really moved to see that, because one, it was a confirmation that we were doing the right thing, but it also really helped me to see that Master's just making this happen. And we're showing up to kind of fill in the slots that he's put out. And the social dynamic especially that really touched me was, sometimes people think that a community is about all my friends. You know, I'm going to have friends here and they're going to like me and I'm going to like them. But Ananda is about everybody being in tune with the same vibration, and then your relationships with each other are really not based on your attunement with each other, but the fact that you're all in tune with the same thing, and then all of a sudden you're also very close with each other. And of course, within that, you have karmic. You just have people that you have deeper karmic connections with. You fall in love and marry somebody, or somebody becomes your particular friend. But the real energy of this, and I don't know if Daya has told this story herself, but was a very interesting example, and she came fairly early, and she was a real proof of it. Daya, as you all know, is an extremely outgoing person. She was just talking to me about, she said she's always just loved people, and she loves to be with people, and so wherever she is, she's just so friendly and outgoing. And she arrived at Ananda and felt immediately drawn to it. And she was also a very successful businesswoman and just really powerful and capable on her own. And she started working the room, as she put it, which is, you know, what she would normally do, meeting everybody, making friends like this. She described herself as being like Teflon. She said she just couldn't make a connection anywhere. And she's attractive, she's charming, she's intelligent. She said it was like she didn't exist. No matter how she tried, she just kept slipping off and couldn't make it work. Finally, she just said, I'm here for the masters, and that's why I'm here. The rest of it is incidental. She stopped doing any of that, just started concentrating on the masters, and almost immediately she was connected with the group. It was like that, and that to me was so interesting. It's like there is no way to connect to Ananda except through the masters. And that was the same as 1976 when the house was burned down. There is no Ananda except for master's vibration. And I've always felt very confident in the power and success of what we're doing, because I feel, that was the phrase I used, there's a magnetic honesty. There's a magnetism that just is going to keep it honest. And when we mess it up and fall out of tune and struggle with each other and pull on the wire and get electrocuted, whatever happens, it all, after a while, everybody's karma plays itself out, and then that essential honesty replaces itself. And now it's all over the world. And you go to all these different places, and as soon as you get there, it's there you are again. You're just right in that vibration. And if that vibration isn't there, the thing never takes hold anyway. So even when they're tiny, like two people here and two people here, they're still holding, they're pulling on that wire, and it'll make itself what it's supposed to be. And Swami often said to us, he said to us about our school when we were struggling with certain parts of it, he said, just basically, I don't care how big it is as long as it's true. You know, just don't compromise on these essential principles, and if it stays tiny, that's just fine. You know, don't try to grow it by compromising that essential nature. That, now, of course, we can be very, very creative, and we can be very innovative, and we can do things no one ever thought of as long as it's on that wire. And that's the tricky fun of it. I always tell people, you can be as creative as you like as long as you've got the courage to take the feedback. So if it turns out not to be right, if you can just hear that, oh, that didn't work and this is why, and then we'll just try something else, see where it goes. Anything else? All right. I've said about all I can say. No, that's not true. I can talk forever, but I've said all I might say tonight. Okay. Thank you all.
We were ever scared of Swami.
You mean, I know. Isn't that dear? I'm so sweet. Yeah, you all understand from the heart so easily. Yeah. He was so sweet when he came here. He was so happy to come here. When he decided to come, he had just finished conversations with Yogananda, and that was, he had poured into that book everything that was left in the notebooks. And like that had been like unfinished work. He was living in Italy. His health was poor. He was in one of those cycles. He finished that book, and he, you know, we would talk on the phone a lot then. And he really thought his life might be over. He just really thought he was done. And I remember a conversation, and he was saying he'd been ill and weak, and he was telling me on the phone that I'm sure I'm not the only one he told. He just that he was telling me. He said that the other night he said I just could have slipped out of my body so easily. He said I was just so close. I could have just gone. And I said, sir, you've done the work of three lifetimes, and you've three of ten men. It would be so selfish of us to ask you to stay. If you're ready to go, then you know, don't even think about anything. Just go. And then I added, I said, but sir, it's not going to be much fun to be on this planet without you. And he answered me so sweetly and so seriously. He said, I know, I've been through it. And he's just like, you realize, I mean, he was 25 when Master died, and how was he 77? I mean, almost all of his spiritual life was after Master. I know, I've been through it, he said. When he died this time, I often thought, oh, well, you know what this is. We'll miss you. But then, just out of nowhere, he calls up and he says, I'm thinking of moving to India. And then he just said, come over and we'll talk about it. And he just, Durgan Badura and David and I and Jyotish and Devi, I mean, we were just, the next day, we were all on a plane to Italy. And we were going to go and come and talk about his coming to India. And we arrived in Assisi there, and Swami was much stronger then. And he's on the train platform to meet us. We just had flown straight from America, and without stopping, we're getting off, we're finally there. He takes us into a pizza parlor. Shivani and Arjuna were there, and Kirtani and Anand. We're sitting in a pizza parlor, and before we ordered the pizza, but before it arrived, it was clear that Swami was moving to India. And that he just felt called by Master, and that as crazy as it was, he was just going to do it. It was time to go back. I mean, this is enormous for him because he was pulled out of here, and it broke his heart to have to leave in 1962. So, and then when the pizza arrives on the table, Arjuna and Vidura and David, my husband, are conferring. If Swami's on his way to India, we better get over there, because where is he going to go? Where is he going to land? So they turn to Swami and say, what city? Where are you going? India. New Delhi, of course. I mean, because for him it was 1962, and he had been busy doing something. He'd been pulled out. Now it was 2002, but he was just going to take the next step. He was going back to Delhi. So by the time we had finished the pizza, they had tickets. And Arjuna wasn't there. Arjuna was in India, actually. Shivani was there. Arjuna was here for some reason. And David and Vidura had tickets, and the next morning, I mean, they slept in Assisi, and the next morning they got back on the train. They went back to Rome. They flew to India. They got tickets for Durga and I for like a few days later. In between, Swami called Dharmadas and Nirmala. So they packed up their house, and Durga and I flew through Istanbul, and Dharmadas and Nirmala met us there. Somewhere there was another pizza. There was another pizza in the restaurant. And Shivani's on the phone with Arjuna, and the three guys are looking for property, and they had looked at 10x8. They looked at 10x8 first. Arjuna had seen that this property when it was coming up years earlier, and Shivani and Arjuna had thought it would be a great place for an ashram. So when they came, they went back, and they saw 10x8 as the first place. They saw 25 other properties afterwards. But that was the one they thought was it. And they're on the phone telling Swami about that house and why it was perfect, and it had this separate entrance and this in the neighborhood. And Swami said, Gurgaon, that's just so far away. I mean, when he was here in 62, this was just the outer edge of wilderness. There was nothing here. But they assured him that it was right. And then I was sitting next to him, and he quoted Sri Yukteswar to Master. All doors are open, it's now or never. Like that. And then he decided, and then plans were underway. And before Durga and I left, Chechu, you were there when we were dyeing the clothes. Swamiji went into his closet and he pulled out all his Indian clothes from when he'd worn them in 1962. And he pulled out this big hunk of Garawa dye. And I had always taken care of his clothes. And so he gave it to me, and Cecilia and Laura and I went into Laura's laundry room, and we re-dyed all these clothes. They were horrible, worn, full of stains. And Laura was a very proper person, and we sat and we had tea in the laundry room while we were working on all of this. And it was cold. And then we took all those clothes and hung them on a clothesline outside her house. So all of a sudden, flapping in the wind are all of Swami's orange Indian clothes like this. And he and a small group came. Oh, dear. They came up the road. And he stood there and he looked at that. I mean, it just meant everything to him to come back to India. And he looked at those clothes and he said, "Now I really feel like I'm going," like that. It was quite a moment. I mean, it meant so much to him to come back to here, to bring it, to see what it would mean. Huh. Those clothes, however, were horrible. So as soon as Durga and I got here, the first thing I did was find him some new clothes. And
he
kept on wearing them for a while. Yeah.
Did he change the color?
Yeah. We bought him some new things so that when he came, he had in his little closet. And it was so, and we took a little picture of the closet with all these neat orange clothes hanging in there. I dyed him some wool. It was cold. We dyed him some wool shawls. And it was quite something. And it just, and then he wrote that brochure, which you all may remember. And, you know, just getting a glimpse into his mind, time for Swami didn't exist. It just he had a sense of eternal now. So for us, between 1962 and 2002, some time had passed. Not for Swamiji. He was going to build a temple for Master. He had gotten Nehru's permission to have this land. He was going to build Master's work in India. He knew just how to do it. So in 2002, when he came, he just picked it up where it had left. And then he talked about, okay, now we'll do it. And, you know, everybody else's mind is working in all these other channels. We have all these different ideas about how this is going to work, and he's just pulling this thread right over. And here I am, and now we'll get that land, and now we'll build this temple, and here we are. And, well, you all are here. This is the rest is history. Quite something. It was very exciting. It was fun for us. We were here. I guess it was November.
It was the 23rd of November.
You remember well. Did you come in that first wave?
He called me after a month.
After a month. By then we'd gone back to America.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, David.
I started the work.
Yeah. You were right there at the start. But we were living in this place called the Om Guest House. I don't know where that is. It's somewhere not quite close by here. And we had this house. And, you know, it was all like, we'd wake up in the morning and just start thinking about things. Oh, we have a house. We have to furnish this house. And Durga and I would just go out every day and shop. And we'd come back home with just bags and bags, which we were just piling in the corner of this guest house. They just gave us the whole guest house. And this pile of material things was just growing out like this. Oh, silverware. Oh, cups. You know, pillows, blankets. Oh, beds. We need beds, you know. And we were just running all over, just buying stuff. There was I guess we had American money.
Yeah, there was
that's right. Yeah, we had a lot of American money, and we just, and then.
I mean, not a lot, enough.
Enough to buy sheets
then,
and.
Pretty
yeah, and then Cecilia showed up a month later. By then we went.
Yeah.
And I remember Durga and Vidura and David and I, who had lots of responsibilities back in America, just sitting on the bed there because it was just beginning. And Dharmadas and Nirmala were invited here to be in charge. They'd never been to India. They'd never set foot. Pardon me?
They got the union.
Yeah. And it was just all so there. And we had returned tickets to America, but we had a serious discussion that, we can't leave until whatever we're going to be ignoring in America does not have the importance of staying here until Swami is settled. It was just a question of getting him settled because I guess Durga and Vidura came back, but David and I were never part of the team here. But we all just said we've just got to stay here until he's settled. And then fortunately he was settled. Soon enough we all went home, but by then he was calling all the others who really belonged here. Yeah, it was quite a moment. Yeah. And we were, I remember the first time we took him to a mall, not to a mall, but a mall. And we had this idea somehow that he would be, we're so narrow-minded, we had this idea that he would be dismayed or put off by all of that. Instead, he was so interested. He was just trying to tune in. He was just so interested. And he tuned into it very differently. He was very happy to see that that India was really coming up and that it was moving out of the past and moving into the present and into the future. And he just walked all around that mall and looked at everything and then said, we should have a store here. Absolutely like the last thing anybody had thought of. We should have a store here. And I started, because nobody had anything particular to do, I went over there and I met the manager of the Metropolitan Mall, who was an extremely nice man, who took a great interest in us and really tried to help us to get that store. He left that job like 2 weeks after it was arranged. But it was just, and of course everything just came out just like it was supposed to, but it was quite an adventure. And the rest of the story is yours because you were here. I went home after 3 weeks and then just popped back in on a periodic basis like now. And then Swami, just got sick just continuously. And one time when he was in the hospital and I had popped back in, and some Swami from Rishikesh, who I have no idea who he was, I never saw him before or since, he came to Delhi to see Swami Kriyananda because he'd heard of him. He'd heard that he was in the hospital, so he just wanders into the hospital. This was Privat Hospital over here, and Swami checked in and out of it like a hotel. He would just come in, and they would say, your usual room, and he would go to his usual room. They would put him in the hospital he was having his legs. It was before the pneumonia. His legs would swell, and the only way to get him to rest was to put him in the hospital and elevate his legs and work with the fluids. He was having congestive heart failure, which sounds terrible, but that's what it was. So he's in the hospital, and the Swami comes, and the Swami says, oh, I'm so sorry to see you ill. And Swami says, this is how he said it, oh, I'm just doing tapasya for the work here, don't worry about me. Just like that. And then it got much worse, but it was always, oh, I'm just doing tapasya for the work here, don't worry about me. And he did. I'm going to put all those stories in a book. Pray for me, because it's a big job. But they really need to be somewhere. Yeah. Okay, that's it. That is it. That's this book. It's called Dharma Equals Victory, The Story of Swami Kriyananda and the Founding of Ananda. When I last visited with him, he asked me if I would write the story of Ananda. And I told him, of course, I want to write about you. And he agreed. He asked me to write a screenplay for the fight for religious freedom, make a movie out of the SRF Ananda lawsuit. He also raised the possibility, this is my favorite part, that I could play the part of Dayamata in the movie. I didn't realize how funny that was until I told a friend of mine. And she became hysterical with laughter, and then I saw the irony of it, and we laughed for about 10 minutes together. But the truth is, actually, whether I do it or not, it has to be done by someone like me. Because it has to be a true spiritual person who plays that part, because she is a great soul. And it has to be nuanced, or else, I mean, it's a very nuanced story. It can't be done like a cartoon. The whole conflict is very subtle. And every SRF person has to really be a sincere disciple of Master, or else the movie wouldn't make any sense. So it's not a ridiculous idea, but it's a ridiculous idea. So we'll see what happens. And he asked me to write a spiritual novel. He was writing Love Perfected. We need more spiritual novels, he said. And he said that the first 1 minute after I saw him, and then every day he asked me if I had the plot of the novel yet, and if I had started the screenplay. Swamiji, I'm still jet-lagged. I haven't done any of those things. But when I was in seclusion and I was trying to think about how to write about him, he put in my mind that the story of Ananda and the story of him, from my point of view, are the same story. Because the only thing I know about Ananda is how he built it. And because I never actually lived at Ananda the way Shivani and Jyotish and others did, who actually were an independent part of the building of the community. I was always in Swami's aura, and I never independently related to the community. So that's my story, and he knows that. So that's when I realized it's the way Swami built Ananda. It's insofar as I can, what he was thinking, why he did it, what the consequences were, and thus how the thing was formed. I mean, there's as many stories as there are people there, but this is the one that I can tell. And for me, it solves the problem, which is I feel that I'm a memory bank and a witness in this peculiar way, because I never lived in Italy, I never lived in India, but I sort of witnessed a lot of those things, and he told me a lot about what he was doing. So I can't fill in huge parts of it, but I can give a skeleton for a lot of it. And I think it's, one, it's a story worth telling, and two, there's a lot of learning in it that I would like to see preserved, just about how things are done. Plus, as I said, lots of, like superconscious living, which nobody even remembers, which was, at the time, his way of changing the world. And it still could be, if somebody wants to take it. It's a life work for someone. And I'd like to just get a few of those things out in the open. So anyway, pray for me, because it's a big job, but fun. So the name Dharma equals victory, when we were doing the Ask Asha book, there was a lot of conversation about what the name of that should be, whether it should have my name on it. And I woke up and I thought, Dharma equals victory. And for a while I tried to put it on that book, and it was about 400 times bigger than the book, the title, and everybody thought it was a crazy title. And then I woke up the next day and realized, oh, it's the title of the next book. It's not this title, it's that one. So at least for now, that's the title. So we'll see. Thank you all very much. I'm really grateful to spin all this out, and thank you for your patience, because I am trying to write this book. And this is this book. And so the more just that thought about the relationship between him writing that book, him standing up to SRF, and his attunement with Master, that's a very important idea that I didn't really see. So I'm airing all these thoughts to see how they come out. And remembering the laundry room, and all of that. That was a day. Okay.
Thank you.
My pleasure. Indeed, my pleasure. Thank you.
It's wonderful to be always.
I feel that way about it too. I get a little carried away. I'm glad you enjoy it. Yeah, it can just, yeah. After I write that next book, I can relax.
You know, Sadhana has a good name. I don't think this kind of books are now in the market.
Yeah. I think it'll work.
Good to sell.
Yeah, that's right. That's your business, you know. Yeah. I think it'll work, actually. I have to just figure out the point-to-point you know, of all the possible stories, what are the real ones that need to be written, and then just start. It's all inside my head, and some of it are in the files that I have. So
it's a good idea. We can inaugurate or start this book with the big bookshop stores here, and the writers do. It's a very good way to promote the book.
Yeah, I do think this will be a really important big book. I think I did the others to learn how to write this one.